NHS figures suggest 1 in 5 people suffer from irritable bowel syndrome. IBS involves stomach pain, bloating, and other assorted nasty stuff. One survey by a company making drugs to treat IBS found 1 in 6 sufferers had never told anyone about the pain they were in. We'll speak to a couple of sufferers very shortly. I just want a quick word with the gastroenterologist we've got with us, Dr. Simon Smale from York Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust. Can you just clear something up for me? When I was writing that introduction, I think it originally said IBS causes stomach pain, bloating, etc. But is IBS the cause or is IBS the symptom? I'm not quite clear. Is it just a group of symptoms?
Yeah. So irritable bowel syndrome is a positive diagnosis, which is really a descriptive term used for a collection of symptoms, including abdominal pain, bloating, altered bowel habit, which may be constipation or diarrhea. And that diagnosis is made in the absence of other disease, but often with a very positive sounding history, defining those symptoms often over quite a long period.
I remember 20 years ago, a friend of mine at university had it, and he was told by the doctor who was a friend of his, said, look, take it from me, somebody diagnoses you with IBS is because they ruled out everything else and don't really know what's going on. I mean, have we moved on from that 20 years ago?
We absolutely have. I mean, I think 20 years ago, we weren't really certain even where in the brain gut sensation went to, and now that's been clearly defined. And we understand much better that irritable bowel syndrome is caused by a complex interaction between our brains and the nerves in our gut, but also our lifestyle, our emotional stresses, and even the bugs that live within our guts. And we know that altering any one of those may trigger symptoms in an individual who's susceptible.
Okay. Zoe Salmon-Corry joins us. So I'm sorry to read, Zoe, you've been suffering with it for 15 years now, which is long enough for any man, woman or child. So when did it start for you, Zoe?
Hi, Adrian. Hiya. Yes, it started for me when I was about 17 and it basically came from nowhere. I was always a healthy teenager and I was working in my part-time job at the time. And I just basically collapsed that evening working in the clothes shop and my parents had to come and get me. And when I went to the doctor, basically, I mean, a lot of IBS sufferers will tell you that sometimes it is difficult to diagnose it and it can be misdiagnosed and go undiagnosed for years. And initially at the time I was told that I was intolerant to certain things. And so really it wasn't for many years later, a bit like what you said about your own friend from university, you know, it comes to a point where you rule out so many other things that you're left with then just knowing that it was IBS. And that then is what happened with myself. And, you know, I went for years of just having these attacks. And they were very sporadic. Sometimes it would be maybe once a month or once every couple of months. And the pain was just excruciating where I would be doubled up and being just ill for hours in the bathroom. Like it wasn't something that passed quickly. It was something that went on for a number of hours. And what I find, and it's something that actually I know that the IBS network and themselves advocate, is to keep a food diary. And I really started to find out for myself and eliminate foods in my diet that would be the trigger foods that would instigate my attacks. And so I had to really manage it a lot from the food diary. But then what would happen is I would go on holiday and, you know, I would be in these restaurants or cafes and eating all these foods and I wouldn't know what was in it. And then the IBS attacks would come back. But for me now, how I manage it is I actually have found a natural supplement that I take, Alpharex, which has actually alleviated all the symptoms. And I've now been completely symptom free from March, which is a miracle for me because I've lived with it for so many years and now I don't have it.
What about the psychological aspect to it? Is there a sense that, oh my God, I've got it and I'm going to get it? You know, I don't know. I saw you got married recently, and I was just thinking, if that was me, I'd be thinking, well, I'm bound to have it on the big day, or I can't have it on the big day. Is there any sort of psychological aspect that you recognise to this?
100%. I think because I had suffered for so long since I was 17, and as I said, I knew which foods to sort of avoid.
So what were they in your case?
For me, it was any rich foods. It was sauces in particular, and creams, and also like anything that wasn't made pure from scratch. Like you can make your own foods per se, but if you go out and maybe get a convenience food and there's all these E-numbers or nasties or everything or whatever, you know, different types of food stuffs in it that you just don't recognise if you were to make it from scratch yourself. So I had to learn to avoid those things. But you're right, it's always at the back of your mind and you always think, but, you know, I'm asking for this in a restaurant and I'm making sure that it's a pure food and there's nothing else in it. But you never know, sometimes mistakes are made and you eat something that triggers it. And for me, I was just very fortunate because I'd started to take that natural supplement weeks before I got married and it had worked for me. And the product does actually work for 7 in 10 people, their trials have said. And I was just very fortunate that it did work for me. And it meant that when it came to my big day and being on honeymoon, I never had any issues at all. So I'm one of the lucky ones that I found something that works for me and that completely manages my IBS.
Okay. Simon, yes. In Zoe's case, that sudden onset, the sudden cramps, is that normal? Yeah. I'd assume I had appendicitis or something. I don't think of it coming on that dramatically.
Okay, well, it certainly can come on dramatically. It's certainly not atypical. There's often a trigger, or quite often people find that there's a number of things that all come together. So it may be that someone's under a bit of stress and then they get an episode of gastroenteritis. So although for some people there is one trigger, for many patients, there are a number of triggers that all come into play. And it's difficult to isolate one thing such as diet from another thing such as, you know, getting married or a big family event. But the story of having a sudden onset and then for the symptoms just to come off and on for years is really not unusual.
And what about that homeopathic remedy, if I can call it that, or supplement, as Zoe described it? Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Alpharex is essentially a probiotic, which is a bacteria, and we certainly know that bacteria that live in our guts, after all, there is more bacterial DNA inside us than human DNA, has a strong influence on the diseases we get. And not surprisingly, the gut diseases are a big part of that. We know that there are some strains of bacteria that promote inflammation. There are other strains that seem to dampen down inflammation. There are even some bacteria that promote the production of cannabinoids and endorphins, which are like our own kind of opiates within the body, and seem to have a role in relieving pain within the gut, but also controlling our emotions, hence the term kind of gut feeling, I guess. And so there's no question that the microbiome, which is what Zoe's talking about with taking Alpharex, has an influence on the symptoms that we get in relation to our guts.
So if your symptoms persist, then what should... What do you need to rule out and what tests you need to do? Presumably you need to have your stool examined. And are there sort of various those awful oscopy type things that need to be...
Okay. Well, most people probably don't need an oscopy. I think anybody before the definitive diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome is made should make sure they have celiac serology. In other words, make sure they've ruled out a true allergy to gluten, which is a protein in wheat. They should also have a set of blood tests to make sure they're not anemic and they haven't got raised inflammatory markers. And if those are negative, for most people who don't have what I would call red flags, so things like weight loss or rectal bleeding, then one, in the context of a good history of abdominal pain occurring more than once a week, associated with change of bowel habit, perhaps worse when opening your bowels, then you can make a positive diagnosis, hopefully without being subjected to all sorts of unpleasant oscopies, as you say, or Sometimes if you do have other symptoms, such as rectal bleeding or weight loss, or it troubles you a lot at night, then there may be an indication to pursue other investigations.
Okay. Matthew Chaddock, any oscopies for you in your IBS history?
Yes, a couple, which were, quite unpleasant. But, just a couple along the way, which didn't show anything, unfortunately.
When did yours start? We heard Zoe at the age of 17 working in a clothes shop suddenly bent double almost completely out of the blue. How was it with you?
Probably a little bit earlier, maybe around the age of sort of 11 or 12. Just didn't start all of a sudden, just something had been there for quite a few months and was just getting worse, sort of cramping and sort of bloating, typical IBS symptoms, really. And it didn't seem to be getting any better.
So how did you tackle it?
Went to see the doctor, just the usual GP, got some sort of basic advice, and then sort of left to get on with it, really. Managed it reasonably well for a few years, and then it started getting worse again.
So where are you now with it, and what's working for you?
I sort of keep an eye on my diet, have worked out what foods I should avoid.
And what is it with you?
Similar to what Zoe was saying about sort of really creamy, fatty foods. Also try and avoid onions and garlic as well, just things that cause quite a lot of gas. So overall, you can do a lot to help yourself. And, it's a lot better than what it was a few years ago.
I mean, it's bad enough for everyone. It's certainly bad enough for blokes. But for you, Zoe, you're in a kind of a glamorous type business. I see you describing the Belfast Telegraph as the banger-born beauty, which has got a nice ring to it. But, I mean, you're not feeling, you can't be feeling very beautiful if you're suffering from gas and bloating and pain and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not the most glamorous topic to talk about, which is actually one of the reasons I did want to talk about it, because I think so many people maybe think they do have it or they don't want to go to their GP, they're too embarrassed, and I'm happy to chat about it so that, maybe some of your listeners think, goodness, that could possibly be what I'm suffering from, and it'll encourage them to go and see their GP. But certainly, I think because I did, like how Matthew was saying, we both discovered over the years what foods to avoid. It meant that when I was doing my sort of glamorous job, if you like, whether it was on TV or on a red carpet or whatever, I knew that day or, the day before, whatever, I knew to live, I suppose, holistically to avoid certain foods that I knew would trigger it. And as I said earlier, I think where it really went wrong for me and I used to get the worst IBS attacks would be then when I wasn't working and I wasn't being sensible and I wasn't being mindful of those foods that would trigger it. And I was on holiday and just, letting my hair down and, being in restaurants and cafes and ordering these foods that I wasn't 100% sure what was in them. And that's when I would get my worst attacks. So really, when you're on holiday and you're thinking, oh, this is great, I'm off work, I'm relaxing, I would spend most of my holiday in a bathroom.
Simon, it strikes me as one of those things where if you've got it, you'll end up Googling it. And there's a whole range of homeopaths and people who test for allergies. And you could kind of end up with analysis paralysis here. People, telling you a million different things and trying a different things. You could just end up confusing your own mind and body. Now, I suppose I'm asking the right person because, as a medic, as a clinician, I'd expect you to be cynical.
Okay, well, I think in terms of kind of sensible advice, I think in terms of diet, and I'd start with diet because after all, what you put in the tank influences what happens to the engine, as it were. I'd say people should be taking regular meals, avoiding long gaps between meals, not surprisingly avoiding excess caffeine, alcohol, fizzy drinks, and the things that they know trigger rich foods, as both Matthew and Zoe have said. And then if all that's not working, people think about exclusion diets of specific foods, such as wheat or FODMAPs. And then I think Zoe says living holistically. I think absolutely. Those factors are really important. Making sure you find time in the day to relax, taking regular exercise, making sure your sleep's okay, and that you're not managing the stresses in your life. I think drugs do have a role, but to be honest with you, the drugs are not particularly great at this at present. And they perhaps only work for between 1 in 6 and 1 in 10 people. So they're not the answer to everything. And very often it's all about managing lifestyle and our diets and the way we're living and our emotional stresses. Psychology certainly plays a role. And sometimes if for people with particular stresses, getting psychological support is important. And, certainly alternative therapies work for some people. Hypnotherapy is probably the best evidenced of all of those interventions in terms of alternative therapy.
What about fasting? Because sort of superficially, that would seem to make sense, just fasting for a while, giving your body the chance to cleanse itself. Or am I just talking out
loud? Okay. I think that's probably talking out of your hat. Although clearly, if you don't, we have to eat at some point. And if you don't eat, you people with IBS, because they're not stimulating their guts, tend not to get symptoms. But in terms of long-term management, it's probably not a sensible strategy for addressing the symptoms, because at some point you have to eat.
Alison Reed is chief executive of the IBS Network charity. What advice do you offer Alison to sort of alleviate the misery of this syndrome?
Morning, Adrian. As you said, we're the IBS Network. We're the national charity supporting people living with IBS. There's a lot of free information and advice that we have on our website. Now, Zoe mentioned earlier that what we suggest is that you keep a diary, a food diary, and a life diary, so that you start to learn what your triggers are. Matthew mentioned onions and garlic have been, their triggers. Often fruit with stones are triggers. But everyone's IBS is unique to them. What starts with one person, actually another person can tolerate a bit of onion, but somebody just has a tiny bit of onion and it can start their IBS off. But we have a lot of information on our website. Just type in the IBS Network into your search engine, and we give lots of advice about what to do. But certainly their first port of call should be to talk to your GP if you suspect you've got IBS.
Matthew, did you feel that your GP took you seriously enough with this?
I think the GP did seriously, but I think their sort of knowledge was quite limited in it, really. And that's when you sort of start looking around on the internet, as you sort of suggested earlier, and you find all kinds of stuff. For me, the best port of call was going to the IBS Network and sort of looking through their information, really, and sort of getting a handle on what the potential triggers were. What I could do to myself, really, to sort of help symptoms.
Zoe, so got somebody 17, 18, as you were when you first got it, picks up the first symptoms, what advice would you give?
I would say definitely go straight to your GP. That's what I did. And although initially at the time I was told that I was perhaps intolerant to certain things and to try out with that and avoiding those things, sometimes you do need to rule things out, and it's about trial and error before you will get a diagnosis of IBS. But I definitely think that the first step in getting a diagnosis, if you do in fact have it, is just to see your GP. And also I have to say that the IBS Network's facts and tips are all excellent for anyone that wants to perhaps go and have a look at those, maybe even before they go to see their GP. Might give them a little bit of an insight as well.
And Simon, is the first food group you should look to admit? I mean, I'm a vegetarian, I'm trying not to bore about it, but it would seem that meat wouldn't be a bad place to start.
I think it's hugely individual. I think for most people that I see in clinic, the big issue is perhaps not with individual food groups, but with the pattern of their eating. So the NICE guidance for IBS suggests that people should eat regular meals and should not leave long gaps between meals and eat little and often, as it were. And then I would suggest on top of that, avoiding some of the triggers that they recognise. And the triggers are hugely individual. I certainly know I have relatives who say that red wine and meat triggers them. I also have other relatives who say that wheat and grains trigger them. And so I think it's a hugely individual thing, which you tend to only get by experience and perhaps some supervision, dietary supervision, in terms of someone perhaps pointing you in the right direction. So there are other patients I have for whom cauliflower and broccoli and some of those fermentable vegetables very definitely provoke symptoms, beans and artichokes, definitely. But that's very individual.
Are you familiar with the acronym FODMAP?
Absolutely. FODMAP.
Go on, tell us. I can't even pronounce what it stands for.
So fructose, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, and polyols are FODMAPs.
And monosaccharides.
And monosaccharides.
Don't forget those.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. thanks. And they are essentially sugars, which when they get to the large bowel, tend to ferment, and you can imagine that causes gas, and gas causes distension, and that's uncomfortable, and can cause loose stools, and therefore FODMAPs can be a trigger. And there are now, I think, 6 randomized controlled trials showing that under the supervision of an appropriately trained professional, and that's the catch in terms of those things, that low FODMAP diets, avoiding those things, can have a really positive benefit on irritable bowel syndrome.
Well, why do you need a professional to do it? I mean, there's a FODMAP food list I see in front of me.
Okay.
Why not refer to that?
And indeed, there are two really good FODMAP apps in terms of there's a Monash app and there's a King's FODMAP app, which are scientifically rigorous and evidence-based. I think that the dietitians would suggest that you perhaps don't need a dietitian to help you with the exclusion, but it's perhaps helpful sometimes to have professional help in terms of how and when you reintroduce things. I have mixed feelings about whether people need dietetic or professional advice. I think it depends on the individual, probably, but conventional line has always been that they should do it with kind of support and supervision. But I think people in reality do it on their own very often with success.
Okay. And from the IBS Food Network, Alison, the FODMAP, is that something you're familiar with on your on your website?
Yes, we do have 2 dietitians that we work with who are FODMAP trained. And Simon said, the advice is go to your GP first. They may refer you to a dietitian if they think it's appropriate. And you can work with a FODMAP-trained dietitian to exclude and then reintroduce some foods. It's important that you don't stay on a FODMAP, low FODMAP diet for extended amount of time, because there might be an issue about the nutrients. You might not be getting the nutrients that you need. So if you're going to do the reintroduction stage, it's always advisable to do it, as Simon said, with a dietitian. But all that information is actually on our website.
Okay.
There's a lot of free information on our website, but there are there is a membership, and there are lots of benefits if you become a member of the IBS network.
Okay.
We have something called a self-care program, which gives you the support you need to manage your symptoms and the tools to enable you to lead a full life again.
All right. Thank you. Thanks very much to Dr. Simon Smale, to Alison Reed from the network, to Matthew Chadder, and to you as well, Zoe. Just what was the supplement you said? I assume you've got no skin in the game promoting it, but a number of people are asking me what it was. What's the...
Well, I hope it very much works for everyone else as much as it works for me. It's Alflorex, and if you want to check it out, the website is alflorexbiotics.com.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thanks. Thanks very much, Zoe Salmon-Corrie. This is 5 Live Daily.